Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Dyslexia is a learning disability that affects a person's ability to read, but it's not a function of intelligence. People who are dyslexic also tend to be very fast and creative thinkers, according to the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. But many school districts not only do not screen for dyslexia, which is more common than hearing deficiencies among school-aged children, they avoid even using the term as a specific disability. Upper Arlington schools used to be among those kinds of districts. Now the suburban Franklin County district screens every student. American Public Media education correspondent Emily Hanford highlights the district's policies on dyslexia in a radio documentary to air Friday at 11 a.m. on 89.7 NPR News. She joins us now. Welcome, Emily Hanford.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can we just do a brief primer on what causes dyslexia, what is known about it?
Sure. There's been a tremendous amount of research in the past decade or so that's revealed a lot about what dyslexia is. So as you said, it's difficulty learning to read, and people with dyslexia have a problem with phonemic awareness. So they have a hard time sort of understanding the relationship between the letters that they see on the page with the sounds that those letters make. And neuroscience research has shown that there's something different going on in the brain of people with dyslexia. None of us are born with sort of the natural ability to become readers. Reading is not a natural skill. We are not programmed to read. We have to take over sort of other parts of our brain to learn to read. And what happens is there's something different in the structure of the brains of people with dyslexia, and it's just very difficult for them to understand this relationship between sounds and letters. So they need to be taught very explicitly how to read. It is not something that they are going to pick up through a lot of exposure to language in the same way that some other kids will.
I mentioned that it's more common than hearing disabilities or hearing loss among children. What do we know about the occurrence of dyslexia in, I guess, the United States?
So there have been a number of studies, and the estimates range that in the United States, probably about 5 to 12% of kids have dyslexia. There are some studies that show that rate to be even higher. And then there's this tricky line between dyslexia and having difficulty reading, and it's not always like completely clear. So there's a range. You know, some people are very severely dyslexic. Some people have less of a problem. And then there are a lot of kids who struggle to read. 20% or more of kids will have a hard time learning to read, and they're not necessarily all dyslexic. But one of the things that the research has shown very clearly is that what works really well for a kid who has dyslexia in terms of the really explicit and systematic way that they need to be taught how to learn to read, that is actually really good for all kids. So we have a tremendous amount of reading failure occurring right now in the United States. Close to 40% of fourth graders are not proficient readers. Not all of those kids have dyslexia. A pretty big chunk of those kids have dyslexia. And then there's another, you know, half or more of them who are struggling to read and would really benefit if there was a large-scale switch in the United States where our approach to teaching all kids to read was more in line with what a kid with dyslexia desperately needs to be able to become a proficient reader.
So all kids could learn to read the way a dyslexia kid needs to learn to read, but dyslexia kids who have dyslexia can't learn to read the way most kids are taught right now.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well said.
Okay.
Well said.
I can't even remember what I said.
All right, you said it well.
The issue of treating dyslexia is at the crux of an on-again, off-again disagreement about how to teach language between supporters of whole language versus phonics. Now, I'm the progeny of phonics. What's the difference between the two schools of thought?
So there's been really a big disagreement going way back, like going back hundreds of years, and going back to the beginning of the Republic, and you can see this debate actually happening in other countries. This is not unique to the United States
either.
So So to put it's kind of complicated, but to be really sort of simple about it, there's kind of like phonics, which you mentioned, and whole language. And the two basic ideas, so phonics is essentially this idea that kids need to be taught, like I said before, very explicitly, like this is this letter, and this is the sound that this letter makes, and then this letter makes a different sound when it's combined with this other letter. You know, there's some things that seem sort of tricky about English at first glance, but in fact, the vast majority of the English language actually does have rules that govern it, and kids can be taught these rules. So one view is a very systematic, and it's seen as sort of kind of traditional and rote. Like you can think back to, you know, kids sitting in rows and over being told to sound out words. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so that's one of the reasons that there's been resistance to some of that approach. It's been seen as sort of conservative and sort of not fitting in with a more progressive, quote-unquote, approach to teaching. And so whole language is more this idea that kids don't need to be taught really systematically all these things about the way that letters and sounds correspond, but that they can be taught more by looking at the whole word. And they can more be exposed to lots of print and lots of good books. And that if they're exposed to lots of good stuff and people read to them when they're young and their teachers read to them and they're sort of shown the words and shown the pictures on the page and they can kind of guess what the words are, that it'll all kind of come to them. There's been a really rigorous debate, and it's gone back and forth as many things in education do. There's kind of a pendulum shift, like every 20 years or so, you know, one idea is popular and then another idea is really popular. So, you know, like back in the 60s and early 70s, phonics and the sort of more traditional explicit instruction was kind of most popular in American schools and in American schools of education. Then there was a real resurgence of the whole language approach in the 80s and 90s, and it got so tense.
Yeah.
That Congress actually stepped in and essentially in the late 90s said, so wait a minute, we have a lot of research now. What does the research say? Like, which approach actually works? How mm-hmm. should we be teaching kids to read? So Congress brought together this panel of a lot of renowned experts, and they looked over like more than 100,000 studies that have been done on how to teach kids to read over years and years and years. And they basically came up with a report in 2000, which came down quite definitively that there is a lot of evidence that teaching kids explicitly how to read really improves their reading proficiency, and there was really not any evidence that the basics of the whole language approach work. So we got an answer in 2000 that the more phonics-based approach is really good for kids.
But
things change slowly in education. Like I said before, there's a lot of politics around it. There's a lot of beliefs. There are a lot of people who believe really strongly or did believe really strongly in one approach over the other. So just because a congressionally mandated report comes out with some pretty definitive evidence doesn't mean everything changes overnight. I mean, this report was actually delivered to most public schools in America. But I think it, in a lot of schools, like a lot of things, we send down a lot of reports and a lot of regulations and a lot of big new ideas and a lot of laws, and they don't always get picked up by schools because, truthfully, schools are kind of told, like, do this, oh, no, no, now do this.
Right, right.
So, you know, I think the evidence suggests pretty strongly that report did not create very much of a change in how kids were being taught to read, so like what teachers were actually doing in classrooms in America and how teacher preparation programs in particular were teaching teachers how to teach kids to read. There was some research done by the U.S. Department of Education back in 2010 where they went out to see whether or not teacher preparation programs were teaching the things that this congressionally mandated panel found were effective mm-hmm. in terms of reading instruction, and they found that for the most part, no, most teacher preparation programs were not doing that.
Well, you know, one of the things I thought was interesting was that there's another issue, and that's funding.
Yeah.
And whole language is cheaper to teach than phonics, right?
There's definitely an argument for that. I mean,
okay.
I think that to teach teachers how to teach kids in this more systematic and explicit way. So it's more than about just phonics. Phonics is kind of the short term
right.
shortcut way. But yes, I think there is something to that. It takes more to teach kids that way. It certainly takes more than surrounding them with good books and bringing good literature into the classroom. And those are really important things mm-hmm. too. Like surrounding kids with good books and reading to them a lot and getting them to read a lot. That the research shows that matters.
But when a kid is surrounded with all of that, when they get all of that, when they have every advantage and they're still showing up in a school district like Upper Arlington, which is, you know, one of the wealthiest districts in Ohio, and they're still not able to learn to read, then that should raise a red flag.
Absolutely. That should be a strong indication that something else is going on, that there's a real learning, quote unquote, disability. There's a learning difference that needs specific attention. And we have a law in this country. We've had it since 1975. Okay. We have a special education law. And that is supposed to, if a kid has a learning disability and they are behind in school, they are struggling to learn to read, they're in second or third grade and they're not learning to read, that should trigger what the provisions in the special ed law, which say that they need specialized, individualized instruction.
But
that's expensive.
Right. And the districts were falling back on the idea that if the kids were getting passing grades and doing everything else okay, they didn't have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, you can say, I mean, I talked to kids in my documentary who got to high school and they couldn't read.
Right.
And on the one hand, you say, how can that possibly happen?
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, many of these kids are very bright. They're very intelligent. They find ways to cope. We know all of us have things we're good at and we're bad at. And we learn ways to get around the things we're not so good at and to do more of the things we're good at. And kids with dyslexia, they get really good at that. It also takes an incredible toll on many of them because school is also very stressful, and they're experiencing a lot of failure, and they know that they're not reading and not doing the things they should. But often they're getting the passing grades, they're doing okay on the test. They might be doing great. I mean, these might be really intelligent kids who should be able to flourish in our schools, and they're doing fine on our tests. You know, we haven't in the past put the proficiency rates very high on many of these tests. So, they like figure out a way to get by. And they sort of, I think sometimes they kind of fool the teachers in the schools. And there can be this real sort of alternate reality experience that parents go to their school and say, look, my kid hates school. My kid's struggling. My kid's crying. My kid's exhausted. My kid can't read.
Mm-hmm.
And the school can legitimately say, we think your kid's doing fine. And I think in some cases, they may actually think the kid is doing fine. And that's where, and then a real battle often ensues between schools. And because we have the special ed law, it becomes a very litigious battle. Schools become very defensive, and it's expensive to put kids in special ed. So there are reasons why schools don't want to do that.
And as we know, it's expensive not to educate kids properly, too, down the road.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And the cost is much greater. I mean, kids who don't learn to read are significantly more likely to not finish high school, to not be able to go on to college, to go to prison. I'm doing some more reporting now, actually, that's looking specifically at some of the disparities involved here, because we're going to be talking about Upper Arlington, which you said is a well-resourced, very affluent school district.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what happens is that, parents in those kinds of places, when they say, I've been reading to my kids since they were a baby, they're going to great schools. I went to college. My husband went to college. Everything should be fine,
mm-hmm.
and it's not. And then they often have the time and the wherewithal and the money to get the kid tested somewhere else, to hire a lawyer, to hire an advocate who can come in and help them. And so what you have is, and you can see it, I'm doing some more reporting on this, you can really see it in some of the data across the country, that you're significantly more likely, if you are a struggling reader, to get special education services if you're in a more affluent school and if you're a white and more affluent student. But if you are a student in a poor school or from a poor family or you're a kid of color, especially an African-American child, your chances of getting an IEP, an individualized education plan for special education, if you're behind in reading, are significantly less. So if we don't figure out a way to more systematically have all schools properly identify the kids who are struggling and give them the right kind of instruction, we just have a massive, massive disparity problem. And it really is, with all of the other things that get compounded when a kid doesn't know how to read, I think there's a decent amount of evidence that it's causing kids to go to prison. It's causing some kids to go to prison, and it's something we really desperately need to fix.
We are talking about dyslexia today. My guest is Emily Hanford. She is education correspondent for APM Reports, and the documentary she helped produce will air Friday on 89.7 NPR News at 11 a.m. We'll continue our conversation. We're going to hear from a dyslexia expert coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When Billy Gibson was in elementary school in Baltimore County, Maryland, he struggled to spell his own name.
I would have to like ask kids next to me. I'm like, hi, do you know how to spell William Gibson? And I'm because I and like the first and second grade where kids were like already like looking at me like, you don't know how to spell your own name? And I'd be like B-I-L-E-I. And just I just would get all the letters backwards, and I would write the Y's in the wrong direction. The worst thing for me was figuring out between lowercase B and D. I would always get those mixed up and stuff.
Billy didn't know he had dyslexia. Neither did his parents. In the school, however, didn't bother to figure it out either. We're talking about dyslexia in schools with education correspondent Emily Hanford. She investigated the issue in a documentary that airs Friday at 11 a.m. on 89.7. Emily joins us by phone. Also joining us by phone, neuroscientist and co-director of the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity, Dr. Sally Shaywitz. She's the author of the 2003 book, Overcoming Dyslexia. Welcome to the show, Dr. Shaywitz.
Pleasure to be here. I'm so delighted that you've chosen this important topic.
Our brain, we were talking with Emily Hanford earlier, and she said that we're not born knowing how to read. Our brain is wired to speak, but not to necessarily read.
That's correct. When a newborn baby comes into the world, we don't run out and get the speaking manual. Humans are hardwired for spoken language. Reading is different. We are not hardwired for reading. We've only been reading maybe 5, 6, 7,000 years, which sounds like a lot, but it's not hundreds and thousands of years. And so it's acquired, and it must be taught, and it can be taught. And I'm so delighted that you're bringing up so many important points here. One is just to note that we began studying dyslexia several decades ago, and were really excited when functional magnetic resonance imaging enabled us to actually see what happens in the brain as typically a child, but also an adult, tries to read. And what we found was that typical readers use three major areas on the left side of the brain, one in front of the brain, and two in the back of the brain. And then when we looked at dyslexic readers, we saw something quite different. We saw that the area in the front of the brain, left side of the brain, called Broca's area, activated. You could see it was working. There were two areas in the back of the brain, one in the parietal temporal area and one in the occipital temporal area. There was inefficient functioning there. And that, and what's really important and what your listeners must look for when they read about all these exciting scientific findings, has it been replicated? Because if you find something in an individual study, that could be by chance. Mm-hmm. But this finding has been replicated all over the world over and over again. So we now have a neural signature for dyslexia, and that's inefficient functioning of the regions referred to as posterior in the back of the brain. And these regions are particularly involved in automatic and fluent reading. So, and that's been really important because I think many people, including educators, are confused about dyslexia because it's a paradox. The same child who struggles, as you were describing just a few minutes ago, and can't read quickly, fluently, is often very bright. So we're used to people being one way or the other. Oh, he's really bright, or mm-hmm. oh my God, he's a slow reader. Dyslexic children and adults are both.
So there's a whole psychological issue going on there too, then, because their expectations are so much higher. But as Emily Hanford mentioned earlier, they're able to, you know, cope and create a lot of coping mechanisms because of their intelligence. But on the other hand, there must be a lot of frustration.
Oh my gosh! You know, as a parent and now a grandparent myself, you know, children start school and say, "Oh, you're going to love school. Mm-hmm. You're going to read," and then they start school. And they wonder why the children around them are able to do what they can't. And it leads to a great deal of frustration because also, as you've been pointing out, a major difficulty is it's not recognized.
Mm-hmm.
It's not identified. And to give you an example, if you were to say, well, what is the prevalence of dyslexia? There is two different data sets. One would say, well, 4 to 5%. And that comes from schools who typically don't recognize dyslexia or do universal screening. If you were to look at studies where every child has been assessed, you would find that 1 out of 5 are dyslexic. That's huge. That's 20% of the children.
Right. Is there a continuum of dyslexia? I mean, can you be really dyslexic and a little dyslexic?
Of course. Everything is sort of in humans, except maybe pregnancy and life and death.
Okay.
Occur along a continuum. But all along the continuum, people need support because What people get confused about too, and is that you can be successful and be dyslexic. It's how you go about reading, the energy and the effort that you have to put into it. And let me just share two findings from, I direct a study called the Connecticut Longitudinal Study, and in our study we found that if you look at intelligence in typical readers and in dyslexic readers, you find great differences. In typical readers, intelligence is very closely linked to reading. So it's what many people in the population think, well, if you're very smart, you're going to be a good reader. And if you're not a good reader, well, maybe you're not so smart.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually is true in non-dyslexics. But then we looked at dyslexics, and in dyslexia, you can have a very high IQ and read really poorly. So it's unexpected. And in the Senate passed a resolution just this October confirming that. So it's an unexpected difficulty, and schools must be aware of it and accept it. The other really, really important point I want to share with you, because we have a longitudinal study, we've been able to look at reading over time in typical readers and in dyslexic readers. And we found something extraordinary. You know, people talk about the achievement gap between typical readers and dyslexic readers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any idea when that first occurs, when you can see it in a very substantial way? First grade. Because you often hear third grade, fourth. It's there already at first grade, large and persistent. And when we saw that data, we said, oh my God, we have to do something about it. So we actually went ahead and developed an evidence-based screening measure, the Shaywitz Dyslexia Screener, that we gave to Pearson Publishing because we knew it had to be distributed far and wide, and we knew we weren't the ones to do it. So this is a five-minute screener completed by the child's teacher and has evidence that it works. And that needs to be used in kindergarten, in first grade, and in second grade because it's efficient, it's economical, and it works. So schools need to begin to take dyslexia seriously before failure, not after failure.
Emily Hanford, you highlighted the story of Dane Guest. At the end of Dane's senior year in high school, his mom, Pam Guest, had him evaluated for dyslexia, but the school refused to see what she saw in the report. Let's listen.
Characteristics similar to those of dyslexia, but they would not say that he was dyslexic. And I asked the psychologist why she used that phrasing, and she said she would never say that a student is dyslexic. We don't do that. And I said, what do you mean you don't do that? She said, it is not in our realm of professionalism to say that a student is dyslexic. We will never do that.
That is shocking.
It sounds like they're making it a dirty word.
Yeah, I think it's a very complicated question. I mean, you know, as a reporter, I really sort of probed this idea, like, what is going on when schools are not using that word? Is that a deliberate action to keep kids out of special ed? There is some evidence that that's happening in some schools. I think that I think it's also possible that there are people in education who do think that's not a label we want to give kids, that putting them in special ed is not a good idea. So, you know, it's very complicated. You mentioned the letter that was put out by the Department of Education a couple of years ago. And so clearly it's enough of a problem, as Dr. Shaywitz was talking about, it's enough of a problem across the country that schools are not acknowledging dyslexia. Why they're not saying the word, you know, for some people it's literally just not on their form. I mean, that's what they said to me. It's not in the drop-down box on the menu, and so we don't use the word dyslexia. And I think in some places it's simple as that. But I think the problem is that, as you start to recognize dyslexia, if you really did screen every kid, if Dr. Shaywitz's screener was actually used in every school, you would suddenly have a gigantic need. And there's like two basic problems. One, that is a costly problem. There is, evidence that especially kids with pretty severe dyslexia need one-on-one instruction in reading. Other kids may be able to get by doing it in small classes. There also may be that some kids who are mildly dyslexic and get just really good reading instruction in kindergarten and first grade may be good. Maybe they don't need to be in special ed. But the other problem for schools is it's not just money. They just literally don't have the people trained to do it. So if all of a sudden you find out that 15% of the kids in your district have dyslexia, they just literally don't have the people to help. And they're legally obligated to help those children. So the problem is that schools are in legal trouble. If they acknowledge dyslexia, recognizes this kid needs a one-on-one instruction from a highly trained professional, they don't have it. They just literally can't provide it.
That's very well put, Emily. But let me tell you something. Probably one of the very best specialized schools in the whole country is a school in Westchester County, New York, and now in Manhattan, the Windward School. And they don't do one-to-one. They do small groups, and that's possible and to be successful. But I think also what you're saying is really important. You need to have teachers who don't just rotely give a program, but who really understand dyslexia, understand what the difficulty is, and understand what you need to do. So it's not only decoding, but children need to learn to read right from the beginning, and they can connect to text. So they get the vocabulary, the background knowledge, and because they're bright, they can use the reasoning to put it all together. So I think we have a huge problem in this country, because if you look at the NAEP data, National Assessment of Educational Progress, over 30% of the children are not even at basic. So this is a very huge problem. And it's also that, as Emily, I believe, pointed out, the cost is there. It goes to society.
Right.
It goes to the children's family. But it's there. We published a paper in an economics journal where we asked adult dyslexics, what would you pay for to be able to do a number of things? What they wanted to be able to do most of all is read out loud in front of other people.
Dr. Shaywitz, let me ask you something. We know it's a neurological issue. We know it doesn't really have anything to do with intelligence. Is there a point of no return when you talk to adults? I mean, could adults learn to read if you retrain their brain? Because we also know, because of the magnetic resonance imaging, that there's the plasticity. Brains can change. There's a plasticity issue. You can reconfigure them, right?
Oh, absolutely. We have at Yale, most people may not be aware, you can be a distant learner. And all you have to do is come to Yale once a month, and you deal the others through tele-education, if you will. And we had one of those students refer to our center, and we evaluated him, and he had an extremely high IQ and a very low reading level. And as soon as I saw that, I got his phone number. I called him and told him he was dyslexic and how bright he was. And he said to me, all of a sudden, I didn't hear anything. I said, are you all right? He said, I'm crying. And so was I. He was 55 years old. Mm-hmm. And he said, if only I had known this earlier, how different my life would have been. So he can still be remediated. But how do you remediate depression? How do you remediate loss of self-esteem and feeling that this confusion at some moment you feel, boy, I think I'm really smart. I solve problems. And the other thing, I can't read a menu. So we as a nation have to begin to recognize dyslexia deeply. Not, you know, it's amazing that schools, I heard from, I think, a teacher, I won't say the state, that told me that teachers were reprimanded if they used the word dyslexia. This is as if a physician's told you can't say the word heart.
Yeah, well, exactly. They made it a dirty word. Emily Hanford, did you find any evidence that parents were part of the problem, that they didn't want to hear that their kid had a disability like dyslexia?
No, I mean, that's definitely a part of it. There are, and I think there are some differences when you look at the data. There are some sort of differences in sort of cultural beliefs about whether or not you want that. You see some differences by race sometimes. Excuse me. Yeah, it's very tricky. I mean, there are definitely parents who don't want to accept it, don't want to see it, don't want to hear that their kid has a problem. And I think what happens is if your kid does have a problem, right now the American education system sort of relies on a parent who will advocate and push, excuse me, for you to get that identification.
Dr. Shaywitz, we have to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
What a pleasure, and congratulations to your program and to Emily for this. Your program is so necessary, and let me know in the future if there's any way I can be of help or support.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Sally Shaywitz. She's co-director of the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity and author of the 2003 book, Overcoming Dyslexia. We're going to hear from the folks at Upper Arlington Schools about what changed there after parents banded together to make change. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about public schools and how they screen for and treat students who have dyslexia. 7 years ago, Upper Arlington resident Brett Tingley was fed up with district policies that ignored screening and special education for dyslexia. She joined a group of parents to file a formal complaint with the Ohio Department of Education. Now Upper Arlington screens every student and trains teachers and staff to identify and teach kids with dyslexia. Still with us is American Public Media reporter Emily Hanford, who investigated the issue in a new documentary that will air this Friday at 11 a.m. on 89.7. Emily, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Joining us now is the Director of Student Services at Upper Arlington Schools, Kevin Gorman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Also co-founder and president of Upper Arlington Kids Identified with Dyslexia, Brett Tingley. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Brett, tell us about your experience, you know, when this happened, and you have three children, one of whom is dyslexic. When did this happen and what happened?
Well, we knew early on that our child was not learning to read. And so the first person we reached out to was our teacher and the district. And they worked with our daughter, and they said that she had dyslexic-like symptoms. I began reading Sally Shaywitt's book and everything I could get my hands on. They began some interventions, but were not having a great deal of success. And one of the issues that we had to bring to light was, if an intervention is not working, you need to try something else. You need to help our children. And that's what we found. And that's what our group of parents found, was that we were all having the same issue. The district wouldn't say that the kids had dyslexia, and the interventions that they were using were not scientifically based and were not effective.
How did Upper Arlington change its policies? What actually changed, Kevin Gorman?
Well, I interviewed to come down here from doing the same position in Northwest Ohio. And the second day on the job, I met Brett and some of the officers from UA Kid, and they were pretty passionate, and they gave me a list of what their goals were. And I listened, and I read them over, and I did a lot of homework. And at that same time, I was starting to get reports from a private school that said children had dyslexia tendencies. And I thought, what does that mean? And so
it's kind of like having leukemia tendencies.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so I decided that if I was going to get reports like that, it would be better if I could control that variable. And so basically that was when I decided that we would start screening all kindergartners in the district, because it's a child find issue, and I wanted to find them early. So we started to use the comprehensive test, the phonological processing, second edition, and assessed all kindergartners in the district.
Is it expensive?
The test itself isn't that expensive. The timepiece is expensive.
Okay.
So you have to think out of the box, who's going to do it? Who's going to train? You don't have to be a school psychologist to give this assessment.
Okay.
But you have to be trained, and you have to administer it with fidelity.
And there has to be a uniformity and that kind of a thing.
Exactly.
So the sample is right. What did you find?
We found that there were a lot of kids at risk. Some of the people thought that they were at risk because it was so early in the school year that you know, they just hadn't been instructed.
Yeah.
But so we started to pilot a class called Foundations. And Foundations is a multisensory phonetic approach. And what was interesting, after the first year where we piloted that, the second year, these kindergartners went into first grade, and the first grade teachers were saying, there's something different about these kids. They seem that they can pick up things faster. And it was because they had that multisensory systematic approach.
And that goes back to the issue of all kids can benefit from instruction geared toward dyslexia.
And that's why there needs to be a universal design for learning for
like
all
door
children.
Handles.
Yes.
Right.
Well, and I want to commend our district, because now every single child in UA gets Foundations, kindergarten, first, second, and third. So that very critical phonetics piece, phonics, is in the curriculum. And now many fewer children are requiring the real heavy remediation because they're getting that critical phonics early on.
You know, Upper Arlington's so different than so many other districts that are struggling. I think probably the biggest difference is there isn't the transients in Upper Arlington that there are in, say, a Columbus Public School. And some particular buildings have just turnover is ridiculous. How important is that, that a kid stay put?
I think it makes a big difference, and I can only speak personally. I was in 10 schools before college throughout the country.
Okay.
And as a kindergartner, they said I was the best reader in the class. And then when I moved to another state in first grade, they told my parents, this kid can't read. Well, they hadn't taught me phonics. And then once I received the phonics instruction, I became an avid reader. So it might have been that I was not dyslexic. I just needed to learn a different approach.
You know, Brett Tingley, I assume you were taught phonics.
Yes.
As a child, right. Me too. I mean, there's a certain generation that's just was normal and was considered the norm. And I'm wondering if those are the two generations butting heads, because a lot of teachers tend to be from the next generation who didn't learn through phonics.
Well, and the trick, and one of the parts of Emily's documentary that I enjoyed so much is when a district is able to give a teacher, and in this case, Andrea Rosen in our district, the ability to teach children how to read. So our intervention services people, if they don't have the correct tools, it's very frustrating. But when they do have the correct tools, it's so wonderful. It's so gratifying. And for the children, instead of being shamed or told to focus or told, you know, you've done this 10 times, you know, why don't you know this word? Or why are you running off to the bathroom so much? They are given access to to read is access to their curriculum, is access to their future.
Emily Hanford, you spoke to Joe Keith, the school psychologist in charge of evaluating students for disabilities at Barrington Elementary in Upper Arlington when the parents filed the complaint. He pointed to a lack of resources. Let's hear.
A lot of the complaints you hear about schools, well, they're public schools, and they only have so much. Knowing how many reading specialists you have, how many intervention or tutors that you have, you know, it's not an endless supply.
And yet he was talking, Brett Tingley, about Upper Arlington, which is one of the wealthiest districts in the state.
And my contention is that it's really not a resource issue. If you have a strong reading program put into place that's effective.
At the outset,
kindergarten all the way through, a very good early literacy program, you're not going to have to do heavy remediation. One of the things that Sally Shaywitz talks about is the fMRI studies. And if you do this explicit instruction, you're actually recarving the neural pathways. And the younger you do that, the better. Neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to change, wanes with time. If you get those kids early, good phonics instruction early, many of them, their brains are recarved.
And one of the reasons we selected the Foundations program was because it was scripted. And we also found a trainer who could train the teachers with fidelity so that everybody was doing the same thing.
Emily Hanford, how many districts are there like Upper Arlington now out there? The new Upper Arlington, not the old Upper Arlington.
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't think there's a good count. I mean, what we do know looking across the country is there are active parent groups in every state that are really pushing for these changes in their schools. There are a number of pilot programs that are going on. There's some going on in other parts of Ohio. There's some going on in Pennsylvania. There are some superintendents who are really taking the lead on this and starting to say, we only want teachers who are really trained in this kind of reading instruction. That's all we want to hire. You've got a supply problem there. Mm-hmm. So there's not like a sort of one answer to that. We also know that across the country, state legislatures are getting active, often pushed by the parents to pass laws. Passing a law can be a good thing, but often it's about the enforcement of the law and the funding of it,
right,
and, you know, whether it's being carried out with fidelity. So I think there are a number of laws across the country that aren't doing much, unfortunately. But there's definitely an increasing awareness about what's going on. And I think at the end of the day, a lot of it really does come back to teacher training, because what Brett and Kevin were both talking about, I mean, if you can, and what Dr. Shaywitz was talking about, this is not, we don't need one-on-one instruction for every single kid with dyslexia. Many of the kids who are the most severe do, and schools are going to have to figure out a way to give the right kind of instruction one-on-one to those kids. But at some of the best private schools where people pay $30,000, $40,000 a year for their kids to go, they're learning in groups of two or three. And if kids are in a kindergarten class with 25 kids and they're getting foundations really well, lots of those kids who may have otherwise exhibited reading difficulties won't exhibit them. They'll be okay. I mean, I talked to dyslexics who went to Catholic schools in the back of the 1960s and learned phonics from the nuns, and, you know, they were fine. They're still slow readers. I mean, that's what you'll, you know, someone who has dyslexia, you know, people with dyslexia, often never become, like, great readers. You know, they learn how to decode, and they learn to do it, but it's slow and it's laborious. But, you know, you can learn to read, and that good early instruction, like, really pays off.
Kevin Gorman, where does reading recovery fit into all of this? It's pretty popular in some districts, or it used to be at least.
Yeah, that's what I found when I arrived here. And so, one of the things that we did was we trained our reading recovery teachers also in Orton Gillingham. And that, I really feel, has made a major impact.
That's the phonics, right?
Yes. And what it basically did was provide a reading specialist all the tools they needed for whatever kind of reading deficit a child may have. And so by doing that, they could pull in small groups. The children didn't have to go into special education, and they could intervene and provide a double dose for the kids that were struggling. And the other piece about the Orton Gillingham training, it allowed them not just to take first graders. Reading recovery is very limited in how many children they can take, and only first graders. This allowed us to take children and intervene and actually intervene with fidelity with these children, so that hopefully you weren't having to place them in special education.
And Emily Hanford, what about older students where when they only nail them when they're in the sixth grade or seventh grade? They said by the fourth grade you have to know how to read in order to learn.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, if you haven't learned to read early, you're missing out on a lot of other things. You know, you're having to come up with those ways to cope to get the information you need, because what happens by third and fourth grade is the primary way that kids are getting it, or a primary way kids are learning and getting access to the rest of the curriculum is through reading. So, you know, what's great is that the imaging studies that Dr. Shaywitz was talking about do show that our brains are plastic, and people with dyslexia can learn to read when they're in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. It's so much better and quicker and easier if it happens young. And like she said, you know, it starts to get combined with all kinds of emotional problems and stress if you don't know how to read. And also it becomes logistically challenging. I know Dr. Gorman has dealt with this, that if you're trying to remediate a kid who's now in middle school or high school, it's a more complicated thing in terms of their schedule, because they have all these, you know, they need to be in chemistry class and they need to be in algebra 2, you know, and it's all so much better and easier if you get this in kindergarten, first and second grade.
Brett Tingley, tell us about your child, how he's doing.
Well, the beautiful thing is to see when our child did get the proper instruction, my child began feeling better, began reading it at the proper level, at grade level, and then above. And then all of a sudden you seek that is the unique potential of my child. That is the miracle in all this. And that's why I'm so passionate about this. It's really the adults in the room that have the responsibility. So I try to encourage parents, educate yourselves, read Overcoming Dyslexia, read a little bit about the law. Talk to your district. Go in and ask those questions. If you think your child can't read and there's something wrong, there is likely something wrong. But also we need districts to do the right thing. Follow the latest scientific research. Follow what Upper Arlington has done and what is working for those kids. We're having great success. And over the long run, it will be less expensive to get good core reading programs in. And then you have fewer kids that you are having to remediate. So let's not hold back our children because the adults aren't doing the right thing.
Well, I want to thank you, Brett Tingley, for joining us today.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
Your time. Brett Tingley's co-founder of Upper Arlington Kids Identified with Dyslexia, or UA Kid, and also Emily Hamford, thanks to you. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Emily Hamford is the chief reporter on a documentary that will be airing Friday on 89.7 at 11 a.m. from American Public Media. And also Kevin Gorman, director of student services at Upper Arlington Schools, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.